Iran's top military commander says the huge U.S. funding failed to bring security to Afghanistan, a country that's now facing conspiracies and threats. According to Palestinian media, Israel has arrested some 2,000 people in the occupied Al-Quds since the beginning of the year. Tens of thousands of people are fleeing to safety in the U.S. state of Louisiana ahead of a Category 4 hurricane. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. The top Iranian military commander says that the U.S. failed to ensure security in Afghanistan, despite huge sums of money it's allocated to that country. Major General Mohammad Bahadur says that the U.S. has spent more than $2 trillion on Afghanistan, including an annual $4 billion budget for the Afghan army, but to no avail. The chief of the staff of Iran's armed forces said that the Afghan army was ostensibly equipped by the U.S. with efficient military hardware, but the army was too weak, and it failed to stand up to the Taliban. The general noted that the huge American funding failed to bring security and tranquility to Afghanistan, a country that's now facing conspiracies and threats. He added that the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, plundered its riches, and committed numerous crimes before leaving the country with a humiliating defeat. Meantime, the Taliban saying that they are gearing up for a swift takeover of the Kabul airport as U.S.-led foreign forces are pulling out of the country. A Taliban member says that the group is waiting for a final nod from the U.S. to take full control of the airport. This is the group has rallied a team of technical experts and engineers to handle the operations there. The militants seized the Afghan capital in mid-August following a lightning advance against the government. Since then, tens of thousands of Afghans and foreigners have flown out of the country through the Kabul airport. On Thursday, two bomb explosions claimed by Daesh killed scores of people, including 13 U.S. troops. The U.S. Embassy in Afghanistan has warned of a fresh threat near the airport. Since Afghanistan's takeover by the Taliban, Islamophobia has gained momentum in India. Our New Delhi correspondent says that Indian Muslims are being heavily targeted on social media for what's happening in Afghanistan. We have a report.
It is the world's largest democracy, but recent years have witnessed a dramatic rise in violence against minorities, particularly Muslims. Experts say in India, the political notion has changed from making the country a strong secular nation to a theocratic Hindu nation. Hindu extremists, notorious for spreading hatred, have been busy running their show on social and even national media. Now the Afghanistan crisis has even prompted more violence against Muslims.
Due to recent turmoils in Afghanistan, the hatred against Indian Muslims has gone up. There are many social media posts which are very scathingly hateful towards the Muslims. And this is because Taliban are identified with Islam and Muslims.
As the largest minority group in India, Muslims have been facing social, political, and economic marginalization, and the drift has further increased since the emergence of Hindu nationalist government of BJP in 2014. Rights activists say the recent years have witnessed a systematic repression against the Muslim population in India. They say it has become a new normal to target Muslims in particular amid growing Islamophobia and ongoing turmoil in Afghanistan. Based on reports by several rights groups, the ruling BJP party has adopted various laws and taken actions that have legitimized discrimination against religious minorities and stigmatized critics of the government since 2014. Experts believe that such measures could lead to instability in one of the world's most populous nations.
Muslims are feeling day by day much insecure. The rise of mob lynching, the rise of issues like beating of Muslims, beating of pedestrians, mob, cow vigilantes, and issues like these are creating a sense of fear.
In recent years, minorities in India have faced growing oppression against their community. However, India's ruling party has time and again denied any discrimination against the Muslim community, saying India is a democracy rooted in equal rights for all. But critics question these claims, believing that even Prime Minister Modi's slogans of everyone together, development for all, and everyone's trust has been nothing but a move to appease the voters. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
According to Palestinian media, the Israeli regime has arrested some 1,900 people in the occupied Al-Quds since the beginning of the year. Media quoted Palestinian rights bodies as saying that most of the arrests were made following an uprising called Sword of Al-Quds in the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Prisoners Club says that the regime has detained mainly youths to instill fear among them and prevent them from confronting the forces. Tel Aviv has reportedly sentenced more than 50 Al-Quds residents to more than 25 years in jail, while others are facing much heavier sentences. And this is apart from more than 4,500 Palestinians, including women and children, who are held in Israeli jails for years. Many of them are being held without charge under Israel's so-called administrative detention policy. Our Ramallah correspondent Mona Kandil says that dozens of those arrested by the Tel Aviv regime are Palestinian minors, and that itself is against international laws and regulations.
We are speaking about 1,900 Palestinians were arrested in Al-Quds, dozens of them. Of course, so we are speaking about hundreds of Palestinian minors. Dozens of those 1,900 are under the age of 14. It's against all international laws, according to Palestinian human rights as well as international human rights. So it's an attempt to intimidate them as well as to prevent any Palestinian to be engaged in the different forms of resistance, struggle, or activities against the Israeli occupation. In addition to those arrests, since the beginning of 2021, Palestinian human rights said that all over the occupied West Bank, 1,000 Palestinian minors were detained by the Israeli forces. 130 Palestinian women were detained by the Israeli soldiers across the occupied territories. This brings the number of Palestinians who are still languishing in the Israeli jails of over 4,500 Palestinians, because the Israeli forces, the Israeli authorities, use the policy that's known as the revolving door.
Now moving on, tens of thousands of people are fleeing for safety in the U.S. state of Louisiana ahead of what officials warning as a life-threatening hurricane barreling toward the coastline. Hurricane Ida is expected to make landfall off the Gulf of Mexico on Sunday evening with more than 220 kilometers per hour wind speed. That's a Category 4 storm. It could be more devastating than Category 3 Hurricane Katrina that took the lives of 1,800 people in New Orleans in 2005. Officials have issued evacuation orders for many areas. It's led to traffic jams on some highways. The state's governor has warned the storm could be one of the most powerful to make impact in 150 years. The neighboring state of Mississippi has also declared a state of emergency. Now, officials in Australia's New South Wales warning that hospitals will be overwhelmed in a matter of a few months, given the rising number of coronavirus infections and related deaths.
For example, given the case numbers are where they are, I suspect in October we'll probably have the highest number that we do in intensive care. I suspect we've not reached the peak yet there at all. But how hard we work now will make sure we keep people out of hospital, and that's really important.
Now, the Premier urged people to get vaccinated and protect themselves against COVID-19. New South Wales reported a record number of 1,200 infections on Sunday. It also had 6 more deaths. Some half of Australians have been in weeks-long lockdowns as officials are struggling to curb the outbreak. Australia has reported more than 50,000 infections and nearly 1,000 deaths. In France, people have protested against the mandatory health pass, and that's been going on, and people are opposed to restrictive measures taken by the government to withhold the COVID virus. Our Paris correspondent has more.
The holiday season has ended, but the protests against the mandatory health pass are continuing. Only in Paris, 3 different marches took place, dozens all over France. The health pass is an electronic document that people have to show before entering public places. Medical figures show that in areas with more than 70% of people vaccinated, the transmission of the virus and the death qualities are very low. But many people continue to protest because they do not trust the government discourse.
I absolutely don't believe in what they say. We are facing dishonest people, liars. These people want to suppress our liberties and control us.
For me, there is something fishy going on here. I do not have any trust in this vaccine.
But medical figures seem to show the opposite. Today, end of August, 65% of the French population has received 2 jabs of the anti-COVID vaccine. The French health minister, Olivier Véran, himself a neurologist, administered an injection in front of the cameras. He said that people should fear the virus, not the vaccine. French officials say that the COVID crisis is getting under control thanks to the accelerated vaccination campaign and some mandatory measures. In French overseas territories, however, like Martinique, La Réunion or Guadeloupe, the situation is getting out of control because less than 30% of the people there are vaccinated. COVID infections and death casualties are high. Hospitals are full and the lockdown and curfew have been extended. Today, more than 90% of people who arrive in hospitals with severe symptoms of the COVID virus or who die from the virus are non-vaccinated persons. But the mistrust in the vaccine remains high.
Why do they force me to be injected with an unknown product, a pseudo-experimental vaccine? Normally, a vaccine is first tested on animals, then on volunteers. Today, the government threatens and blackmails an entire population. Restaurant workers and health personnel can be fired.
Hospital workers are now obliged to be vaccinated or have to show a negative PCR test. If not, they will be suspended without salary. Most of the protesters do not deny that the vaccination campaign in France seems to be successful, but they would like the French government to use the method of persuasion rather than a restriction. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
Turning to Latin America, Brazil has registered more than 24,000 new COVID infections in the past day. The health ministry also confirmed some 680 more deaths. The country is the world's 3rd worst nation in terms of infections. It also has the world's 2nd deadliest outbreak after the U.S. Meanwhile, Mexico has posted more than 17,000 new daily cases and 760 fatalities. The figures raise total confirmed cases there to over 3,328,000 and the overall death toll to 258,000. Tens of thousands of people are staging rallies in the U.S. Capitol and dozens of other American cities who demand protections for voting rights. The demonstrations aim to pressure lawmakers to pass legislation to counter a wave of ballot restrictions in Republican-led states. Organizers say the state-level moves to curb voting access disproportionately impact people of color. The protests were held on the anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s historic 1963 march on Washington. After Democrat Joe Biden won the 2020 presidential vote, Republican lawmakers in many states reined in the use of drop boxes and mail-in voting. Colin Campbell says the U.S. conservative lawmakers are seeking to prevent demographic changes in favor of minorities.
Across the country, particularly in the Midwest and in the Southeast, you have many states that are passing restrictive voter laws. These things could include not being allowed to register on Election Day. So if you show up, you're maybe a young voter or maybe someone who hasn't voted in the past. If you wanted to register on that day to vote, you would be disallowed in doing so. There are other laws that are being passed in legislatures across the country that would not allow people to be fed in line. Now you're saying, well, that's kind of a weird legislation point, but because of the way that voting booths are set up, you have these long lines because of the access that voters do not have in certain states. There are only certain places where they can vote. So they go to these designated spots, which there are very few of within the population, within the state. They line up. It's in November in southern states. It can be very hot. People can be dehydrated. There are people that feed people in line so that they can last and stay healthy while they vote. Well, they're passing laws so that this is also disallowed. This is not a surprise when you have white conservatives or white hegemons who want to restrict the access to vote for minorities in the country because they see the changing demographic in the United States of America, where it was purely, where it was mostly white, and where white people had most of the power and the access to legislation and voting.
That's a wrap for this news broadcast.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Zainab, peace be upon her, played unparalleled role on the way to Karbala with Imam Hussein on the day of Ashura with all those hardships and after Imam Hussein had been martyred. It is impossible to find a similar figure in history. Later on, numerous events took place during her captivity in Kufa and in Sham. Because of these great selfless efforts, Zainab al-Kubra gained a prominent position before Allah the Exalted. And this is something that we cannot describe. In the Holy Quran, Allah the Exalted mentions the names of two women as perfect examples of faith. God also mentions the names of two women as examples of infidelity. Allah sets forth for an example to the unbelievers, the wife of Noah and the wife of Lut. They were respectively under two of our righteous servants. The Holy Quran, Chapter 66, verse 10. These two women exemplify infidelity. That is to say, Allah the Exalted mentions women, not men, as examples of both infidelity and faith. And Allah sets forth as an example to those who believe the wife of Pharaoh. The Holy Quran, chapter 66, verse number 11.
Ana mazlum Hussein. Ana mazlum Hussein. Ana mazlum Hussein. Ana mazlum Hussein. Ana
Hussein. Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
Ana mazlum Hussein.
He mentions the wife of Pharaoh and Mary as two perfect examples of faith. And Mary, the daughter of Imran, the Holy Quran, chapter 66, verse number 12. A brief comparison between Zainab al-Kubra and the wife of Pharaoh would show the greatness of Zainab al-Kubra's position. In the Holy Quran, the wife of Pharaoh has been recognized as the example of faith for both men and women until the end of time. But just compare the wife of Pharaoh, who had faith in Moses' prophethood and had been enchanted by his guidance, with Zainab al-Kubra. When she was tortured by Pharaoh, according to narrations and historical texts, she passed away due to the torture she suffered. She was frustrated by the physical pain. She said, "O my Lord, build for me, in nearness to you, a mansion in the garden, and save me from Pharaoh and his doings." The Holy Quran, chapter 66, verse number 11. In fact, she was praying for her death, "and save me from Pharaoh and his doings." This was while her problem was only the physical torture. Unlike Zainab al-Kubra, she had not suffered the loss of several brothers, two children, and many of her relatives and nephews. She had not watched her dear ones go to the battlefield where they were supposed to be killed.
It's August 2021 and the Taliban has de facto taken over Afghanistan, establishing full territorial control after it was toppled in 2001 by American and NATO troops who invaded and occupied the country for almost 20 years. The United States' longest war in history has come in at a cost of over $2.2 trillion, with around 3,500 NATO troops killed, and more importantly, over 50,000 Afghan civilians killed, a conservative estimate, leaving millions others displaced and turned into refugees. So what was it all for, people ask? Why did the United States spend so much money and stay in Afghanistan for so long, only for the Taliban to retake the country so quickly and easily? Was it all for nothing? Well, very few seem to be asking what Afghans gained from this war and why they paid with their lives, their homes, and why people thought it was okay to colonize their country for 20 years. Was this really about nation building and fighting a war on terror? Or was it an occupation and a war of terror? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Almost 20 years ago, following the events of September 11th in 2001, a cataclysmic chain of events was set into motion by the neoconservative administration of George Bush and Dick Cheney. The United States and its allies invaded Afghanistan under the pretext of capturing Osama bin Laden and toppling the Taliban, who they claimed had sheltered him and his terrorist organization, Al-Qaeda. Afghanistan quickly turned into a quagmire for American and NATO troops who were unable to catch bin Laden nor establish full territorial control over the rugged and rough terrain of the Central Asian country. And despite this, year after year, every American president since Bush, including Obama and Trump, kept the war going. The defense budget got increasingly bigger, and the arms manufacturers made bigger profits as they provided everything from boots to bullets to tanks and missiles. And all the while, the U.S. was able to maintain a military presence on China's borders, Iran's borders, and in close proximity to Russia. It's only until 2011 that Osama bin Laden was allegedly killed during a U.S. raid. And despite this, the U.S. continued occupying Afghanistan for another 10 years under the pretext of nation building. They argued that Afghanistan wasn't equipped to deal with any of the challenges that it faced and it needed help. NATO claimed to be training the Afghan security forces who were supposed to take over once they left, which would be on May 1st of 2021, as agreed by Donald Trump's administration and the Taliban in Doha last year. And so here we are. And what happened when NATO began to leave? Complete chaos. The supposedly 300,000-strong Afghan security forces that the U.S. claimed it had spent 20 years training and equipping suddenly vanished overnight. U.S. President Joe Biden blamed the entire collapse of the Afghan government and security forces on Afghans, and then had the audacity to claim that the U.S. should have never been in Afghanistan nation building, after he supported the war on terror, the war in Iraq, and oversaw the occupation of Afghanistan as vice president under Obama. Ironically, on July 8th, Biden gave a speech ensuring there will be no humiliating withdrawal from Afghanistan or anything like what we saw in Saigon.
There's going to be no circumstance where you see people being lifted off the roof of an embassy of the United States from Afghanistan.
And of course, that's precisely what happened. The withdrawal was most definitely just like Saigon, if not worse. Just to give you an idea of how fast the Taliban was able to advance and gain territory, on July 9th, the Taliban held 90 districts. Meanwhile, the Afghan government and security forces held 141 districts, leaving 167 districts contested. 1 month later, on August 16th, and the Taliban now controls almost every single district in the country. In many instances, it even took back some cities like Jalalabad and provincial capitals without a fight. Images of people panicking and attempting to flee the advancing Taliban flooded the news. U.S. military planes took over Kabul International Airport, ferrying diplomats, military, and other people deemed worthy enough by the U.S. government of being airlifted out of the country. People were desperate to be evacuated. They were seen scaling the walls of Kabul's international airport, desperately trying to get out of the country. As one of the American planes was preparing to take off on the runway, people could be seen walking alongside it and even clinging onto the plane. A tragic video even showed some people falling to their deaths from the departing aircraft, and another person is reported to have later been found in the plane's landing gear. Again, a very tragic reminder of just who NATO prioritized and who it left behind when the chips were down. Now, a striking photograph was taken showing an American Chinook helicopter flying over the U.S. embassy in Kabul. This immediately drew comparisons to the iconic photos that we saw taken in Vietnam in 1975, when people were being evacuated by helicopter from the rooftop of the U.S. embassy as the People's Army of Vietnam advanced to take the city. Now, asked about these comparisons, a visibly irritated Secretary of State Antony Blinken rejected outright the similarities between the U.S. withdrawal in Kabul and 50 years prior in Saigon.
President Biden said that under no circumstance, and that was his word, those were his words, under no circumstance were the U.S. personnel, embassy personnel, be airlifted out of Kabul in a replay of the scenes that we saw in Saigon in 1975. So isn't that exactly what we're seeing now? I mean, even the images are evocative of what happened in Vietnam.
Let's take a step back. This is manifestly not Saigon.
And yet the mountains of photographic evidence suggest otherwise. Indeed, not just analogously, but tangibly and quite visibly, Biden's Saigon moment had come. Joining me on the program to talk about Afghanistan is Ray McGovern, who worked as a CIA analyst for 27 years. He prepared the president's daily brief for Ronald Reagan when Reagan was president. In 2006, McGovern returned his commendation medallion in protest over the CIA's torture program. And he's been a vocal critic and outspoken activist against war. He even publicly confronted Donald Rumsfeld for the Bush administration's lies on Iraq. On another occasion, he was severely beaten for turning his back in silent protest to then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. He's appeared on virtually every major news network, as well as numerous other radio, TV shows, and documentaries. In recent times, he's even grown his beard in solidarity with political prisoner and journalist Julian Assange. Thanks for coming on the program, Ray. It's great to have you. Just to start out, you know, why do you think the war in Afghanistan was such a failure? I mean, you recently wrote an article for antiwar.com discussing this, and you've offered several explanations. What are they, and why was this withdrawal compared to Saigon?
Well, the activities and the events speak for themselves. The only thing I would point out is that for one group, it was not a failure at all. It was a gravy train. The entity that I call the military, got a pencil? Military, industrial, congressional, intelligence, media, academia, think tank complex. Now, what I say, what do I say media as in all caps? Well, media is the linchpin here. You can't deceive the American people at large without being, without capturing the media. The media, of course, is happy to be captured. And yeah. So you have what Dwight Eisenhower warned against 60 years ago now, the military-industrial complex on steroids. So these people made money hand over fist. I think the latest indications are that if you had stocks in Lockheed or Raytheon, your gains in this gainful period, though, you know, over the last, 20 years, would be 58% higher than the norm of the gains. And, you know, that does not make me wish that I had invested in any of these war things. But it's very instructive, isn't it, how people profiteer on wars and the foot soldier dies or gets wounded.
So, you know, when we talk about the military-industrial complex, which, you know, you've eloquently expanded to include other fields which are indeed complicit, I mean, what concretely made it such a gravy train?
Money. I mean, I just mentioned the appreciation of stocks. A lot of these generals went through the revolving door, you know. Even Austin. Defense Secretary Austin. Well, now, he was head of CENTCOM, the Central Command, which commands that area of the world, Afghanistan, Iraq, and the rest of it. And when he retired as CENTCOM commander, he was really unapologetic about what had just gone on. He testified before Congress just before he retired. And they asked him, now, General Austin, tell us, we invested $500,000, $500,000, in preparing and training good guys, moderate terrorists, to go into Syria and do our bidding. Yeah. How many are still in action? And he looked very stolidly and said, 4 or 5. The next week, he joined Raytheon. Mm-hmm. Okay. He didn't wait a year. I think you're supposed to wait a year at least, maybe 2 years. He joined Raytheon, and then Biden picks him to be the defense secretary 4 years later. I mean, hello, is this a great country or what? So fast forward now to this past 3 weeks. Well, let's go back to when Biden said, we're getting out of Afghanistan, we're getting out of there, we're going to be out of there by 9/11, right? Okay, he said that in mid-April. So, I think it was the 14th of April, 2 months, April, May, June 14, General McKenzie, you know, head of CENTCOM, right, announced this. We're pulling all our air support out of Afghanistan. We're not going to do any close air support anymore. And the only thing that would persuade me to reintroduce air support if there were an attack on our homeland or on the homelands of our allies. It's the only thing. Otherwise, we're out of there. 14th of June, right? 2 weeks later, the 1st or 2nd of July, in the middle of the night, the biggest airbase ever, Bagram, is everybody gets out of town on the cover of darkness without even letting...
In the middle of the night.
You know? Okay. So what's my point? My point is this. What did they expect? The only thing that was keeping the Afghan army in operation was the close air support. Anytime they were attacked by the Taliban, when they call in, and the U.S. would do their bidding. So here, on the 14th of June, the head of CENTCOM says, no, we're not going to do air support anymore. And then 2 weeks later, he made good on that promise by taking all his troops as many planes as they could out of Bagram Air Force Base. Okay? So you're a Taliban, right? Or you're an Afghan army officer or province leader. And you say, you know, I think I'll switch sides. And, of course, there have been all kinds of deals being made for the previous years, actually. So they did switch sides. Taliban comes in, and before you know it, last Sunday, they control the whole country, or almost the whole country. They come into Kabul.
Yeah, and, you know, when we're talking about withdrawal, the troop numbers have fluctuated. As you said, it was 6,000. It was supposed to be 2,500 and go down. But, you know, regarding the CIA, what about the CIA? Because, as we know, the first people on the ground in Afghanistan in 2001 were CIA. They were paramilitaries. And we've heard no mention whether they're withdrawing. As a matter of fact, the CIA director Burns said back in April that they're not leaving. And, you know, that's not been covered anywhere in the media. And what about the private contractors? The contracts are still in place. So is it a real withdrawal or just a withdrawal of conventional armed forces?
Well, the Afghan Air Force, such as it is, can't possibly function without the contractors. Even the helicopters can't be kept in the air very long without spare parts and so forth. So the contractors will have to stay. Huh? You think that Taliban's going to say, okay, you keep our helicopters going and you can stay? Well, maybe, because there are helicopters now, you know. I mean, hello. The whole thing is so sadly ludicrous. The fellows from the CIA that came in on those horses, you know, remember that? All those pictures, they came in on the horses, and they were catering to the Northern Alliance, those warlords that are just worse than the Taliban, in my view. They're gone. I mean, the U.S. military took over. And one function of that, which is worth emphasizing, is that once the U.S. military takes over, once the U.S. military is at war, well, they do their own intelligence. Thank you very much. We don't need the CIA or DIA or anything else. We know what the battle requires. And so just as in Vietnam.
Do you think it's a coincidence that there's no negative coverage of the war, but there is negative coverage of the withdrawal?
No, I don't think that's a coincidence. You know, I have very few good things to say about the Washington Post. Actually, only one. And that is that almost 2 years ago, they printed Craig Whitlock's Afghanistan papers. My God. You don't need anything else to see the lying and the cheating and the profiteering and the avarice and the, you know, the hubris that characterized our top military and political figures. Now, this is documentary, okay? So if anybody listening or watching here would want to know what's really going on, just look up Craig Whitlock, the Afghanistan papers, and you'll see what a charade it was. Actually, not sure. Charade is nice. I mean, it was a war crime. What's going to happen? And lots of people died.
Yeah, I mean, people are focusing very much on the withdrawal and saying that it's been badly executed, it's botched. Do you think it would have been different, perhaps, had it been completed under Trump, since he agreed to this deal with the Taliban?
It's really hard to speculate on that kind of thing. But how? What did they expect to happen here? And so you know, the next logical step, in my view, is did they do it deliberately? Did they want the biggest mess that possibly could occur by simply not doing the necessary planning? It boggles the mind to think they were so dumb, that they didn't get really with it.
So do you think this whole campaign has diminished the standing of the U.S. and its allies across the world as military powers, as nation builders, and so forth?
Well, it was avoidable, of course. It was perpetrated for the wrong reasons. Everything is obvious now, so certainly. You know, here's a specific. 6 days ago, on Sunday, there were three Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, okay?
Right.
Three great big Airbus-type things circling Kabul Airport. Now, those of you who have seen the videos saw these little dots all over the runways, and those were people. And so the Germans were circling around. They couldn't land because there were people there, and they didn't want to land on people, right? Okay, now, what does that say? They had to go back. They ran out of fuel. They had to go back to Uzbekistan, refuel and all that. Now, the German people know about that. Yeah? German people don't know that a week before, some German aircraft took what was left of the beer and the spirits that were left in the embassy and other German compounds back to Germany. They repatriated the beer and the spirits.
Ray McGovern, thanks so much for coming on the program. It was great speaking with you.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
So while the United States claimed it had to invade Afghanistan in order to get rid of Al-Qaeda and those who harbored and sheltered it, who helped create Al-Qaeda in the first place? Was it not the U.S. who created Operation Cyclone with bin Laden and his mentor al-Zawahiri receiving assistance and money from the CIA in order to fight the Soviets? Is the U.S. not supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria right now, now known as HTS, which controls Idlib? Who armed these Salafi terrorists and turned a blind eye to Saudi Arabia's export of Wahhabism? The United States, and even Hillary Clinton, admits this on tape, that the U.S. helped create and fund Al-Qaeda, the same enemy that it claims to be fighting today.
I mean, let's remember here, the people we are fighting today, we funded 20 years ago. And we did it because we were locked in this struggle with the Soviet Union. They invaded Afghanistan, and we did not want to see them control Central Asia, and we went to work. And it was President Reagan, in partnership with the Congress, led by Democrats, who said, you know what, sounds like a pretty good idea. Let's deal with the ISI and the Pakistani military, and let's go recruit these Mujahideen, and let's get some to come from Saudi Arabia and other places, importing their Wahhabi brand of Islam, so that we can go beat the Soviet Union. And guess what? They retreated. They lost billions of dollars, and it led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. So there's a very strong argument, which is, wasn't a bad investment to end the Soviet Union, but let's be careful what we sow, because we will harvest.
So when the Americans and British say that they helped Afghanistan, why are so many people trying to flee then? Why have almost 20,000 people been evacuated in the span of 2 weeks? Was it helping Afghanistan when British and Australian special forces were executing unarmed Afghan men and then planting weapons on their bodies to frame them as terrorists? Was that helping Afghanistan when a video released in 2020 showed Australian SAS chasing an unarmed man, 26-year-old Dad Muhammad, and then executing him in cold blood? We covered these war crimes by Britain and Australia. Here I spoke to whistleblower David McBride, who's facing decades in prison because he helped expose these atrocities. Just a few weeks ago, Daniel Hale was sentenced to 45 months in prison after he blew the whistle on the U.S. drone program, showing, for example, how during a period of 5 months, 90% of the people killed were not even the intended targets. Julian Assange has been persecuted for a decade now and is facing up to 175 years in a U.S. prison because he published the Afghan War Diary, showing how the war was a giant failure in killing scores of civilians. Naturally, you see, there's only negative coverage of the withdrawal, but no negative coverage of this war on terror, or should I say, war of terror. The media loves war. They want to keep people focused on this so-called botched withdrawal, so they don't remember the images of Abu Ghraib or Guantanamo Bay, or the kidnappings, the rendition, and torture. And even more absurd than George Bush and Tony Blair's justification for these wars are people now claiming the U.S. should invade and occupy Afghanistan in the name of women's rights, which they say could be threatened under the Taliban. Now, ironically, these same media liberals and fake anti-war people never say a word about women's rights in Saudi Arabia, a close U.S. ally. The only difference being, of course, that Saudi Arabia gives America enough oil for them to shut up and not care about women's rights. They continue to talk about what to do with Afghanistan and other countries as if they own these countries. They speak like this also about Iran, about Syria, about Iraq, Venezuela, Cuba. This is so indicative of their colonial mentality and worldview. They want to civilize other people because they think they know better. And they don't see other countries as independent sovereign nations that are inhabited by equals. No, they see them as colonies, as vassal states that must be conquered and controlled. They think that they are a force for good when they meddle in other countries' affairs, because deep down, they are neocons. They believe in American exceptionalism. And the West helped create these so-called threats that it claims to fight. And then the West claims it is the only one who can solve these threats through bombs, which is very convenient, of course, for the weapons manufacturers like Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and the military-industrial complex as a whole, which has made so much money from the invasion of Afghanistan and the so-called war on terror. The United States military budget right now stands at over $752 billion. It is the biggest it's ever been in modern history. And the U.S. not only deploys uniformed troops or conventional armed forces, but also private contractors who far outnumber them and are basically paid mercenaries who get paid 10 times more to do the same jobs as enlisted soldiers. So the contracting firms can basically rip off the taxpayer with even more lucrative deals. Rightfully nicknamed the graveyard of empires, Afghanistan was doomed to fail from day one. Everyone knows this. However, it was certainly not a failure for the arms dealers and private contractors who made a killing, literally made a killing. The entire war was never about nation building or about fighting Al-Qaeda or defeating the Taliban. The United States and Britain invaded Afghanistan based on lies told by George Bush and Tony Blair. They completely fabricated and exaggerated these threats in order to justify the invasions of Afghanistan, Iraq, and other countries. And the only people who benefited from these wars are the arms industry and other private corporations. And if people continue to ignore the truth, if there is no autopsy and detailed critique of the war on terror, then people will learn nothing and will be fooled again in the future. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. You are listening to I'm Attar, the host of this program. Please accept our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the arrival of the month of Muharram. Within the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers, Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakh Rouhani, a faculty member of the University of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, doctor. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome to you.
You're welcome, brother. And also, brother Ali Alavian is over here, an Islamic expert from the Islamic House of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, brother, and very welcome to this show.
Wa alaikum assalam, and thank you for having me here.
So, since this is the month of Muharram, and the most tragic event during the history took place in this month, that is the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his companions and family members, his faithful, loyal companions, Brother Mahmoud, the producer of this program, decided to dedicate this session and the upcoming ones to the atrocities and the corruptions that were done by the Umayyads during their rulership over Muslim lands. We know that from 41, we can say AH, till 132 AH, for 91 years, the Umayyad established a government on the Muslim lands, starting from Levant and getting all across the borders of the Muslim lands out of Arab Peninsula and Hejaz, today Saudi Arabia. But all of a sudden, many values have been changed, and many pure Islamic values have been violated. We know that the most horrendous, we can say, massacres happened during this period. We could see that what happened to the family and the companions of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. We could remember what they have done to, in fact, in the Harra event, the massacre of the people and the killing of the people over there. Also, Mukhtar al-Saghafi uprised against them, but he was killed again. And you know that in these 91 years, we can say Islam was deviated from the right path. This was what Umayyads did, Umayyads and their kings and the rulers did to the Muslim Ummah on that time. After the death of Muawiyah, how Yazid unlawfully and illegitimately got to the power, they want to start a kind of, how can I say, morusi or hereditary type of transfer of the power to themselves from the father to the son. And brothers and sisters, just go and check our Sunni references, not the Shia ones, that what a picture Yazid had on that time. The atrocities, the corruption that he did. And the first thing that he did was to take bay'ah from four: Hussein ibn Ali, Abdullah ibn Umar, Abdurrahman ibn Abi Bakr, and Abdullah ibn Zubair. And anyone who confronted you, cut his head and behead his head. Mas'udi in his tariq says that, in his book says that, he was very much like Pharaoh, but Pharaoh was better than Yazid.
Yes.
But Pharaoh was better than Yazid. The rivers of the blood and the streams of blood that he did. On that time, such a guy like Yazid ibn Muawiyah. So, Brother Ali Alavian, yeah. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam did not accept it. As you said, did Khuruj, and on his way, he was to Karbala and then the Kufa, according to the invitation.
It is some, as I said, some believe that Imam did Khuruj, and we do not agree with this term.
No, I mean by Khuruj is that he left Medina
As a sign of
Karbala.
His disagreement.
Yes.
Since he found actually that that the people's acceptance can be actually in the Kufa, he started moving towards there, and he left, and he found even look when the Islam. The expediency of Islamic Ummah is even more important than the rituals and worships. That's
right.
Why he leaves his Hajj incomplete. This is the Imam, this is an Islamic leader that knows that the expediency of Islamic Ummah obliges him to leave his Hajj incomplete. While you can find no one that is permitted to leave his Hajj incomplete. So he moves towards Kufa, and on the way, on his way in Karbala, actually, he was martyred by an earth-saddened tragic event by the troops of Yazid and with his representative in Kufa, that is Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad.
That's right.
So Imam was martyred in a really tragic way. He and his family and his 72 loyal companions and his family were arrested and were sent to Sham.
That's right.
The whole story that some...
Okay, Dr. Fahd Rouhani, let's get to the post-event. The Karbala tragedy is so harsh and tragic that all the details cannot be mentioned over here. Sorry for, as they say, it includes graphic video.
Mm.
It includes graphic events over here. We cannot say what atrocity did Yazid, Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, Shamr ibn Zur Jawshan, and the other agents of Yazid Detour, the companions of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the women and the children. But the case is that after the captives are taken to the Yazid's court, the heads are over there. He starts drinking liquor, and putting trays of chess, playing chess on the heads of the Ahlul Bayt and drinking liquor. He was himself criticized by the people around him, his viziers and the ministers around him, but he continues doing such behaviors from a guy like Yazid and the cruelty that he did towards Ahlul Bayt. What was the main reason for Yazid to show such vengeance toward Ahlul Bayt, not acting mercifully even to their bodies and their heads?
Yeah, the point is simply that he wanted to take revenge and he wanted to silence all others and show that, okay, look, he was the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, okay, and I ordered him to be beheaded, and his body to be,
mutilated, yes,
okay, trampled,
okay? Mutilated,
yes, and then first of all, Yazid wanted to show that he was the absolute power over there, and wanted to silence all others. We find that, the reign of terror in the Umayyad period continued, from the time of Muawiyah up to the end of the period of Yazid, okay? And after Yazid, we find that Marwanids got to power, okay? However, we find that, okay, Yazid's main power was, Yazid's main intention was, not only to silence all his opponents, but to cut off the line of the Ahlul Bayt, okay? But it was just a vain hope. A foolish hope.
That's right.
Because Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, okay, was a survivor of the Ashura tragedy, okay? Now we find that, even some historians who were courtiers, either in the time of the Umayyads or in the time of the Abbasids, when they come to Yazid ibn Muawiyah, they cannot resist, this feeling, okay, to write down, what realities took place over there. Although they were, courtiers, and they were paid by the government, in order to write the history in favor of the Umayyads and favor of the Abbasids. In some places, they reveal some of the secrets that took place. That were used to take place inside the Umayyad courts. Okay?
Although doing curse or doing land towards the companions and the caliphs of the Muslim lands are considered as forbidden by some of our Sunni brethren, but according to authentic resources like Ahmad ibn Hanbal Zahabi, Ibn Ibad, Ibn Imad Hanbali, Ibn Jawzi, and Ibn al-Khaldun, cursing Yazid ibn Muawiyah according to a consensus was done. And see how much a person could be corrupted and how much a scandal he could make during the Muslim moment.
May I have a short comment? Knowing about the reasons of this oppression that he made towards the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam requires to study about the characteristics of the characteristics and features of the government which was introduced by Muawiyah and after him